Welcome to Renee's Book Talk. I'm your host, Yolanda Renee. Tonight's book talk is all about horror with Jonathan Mayberry, whose latest book, Bad Moon Rising, will actually give you nightmares. To call in with a question, the number is 347-215-9536, and the chat room is open. Welcome to the WoW poet who's visiting with us right now. As an author, I started Renee's Book Talk to give a voice to other authors who needed an avenue to market their books. I invite guests who not only have the desire to market and reach a wider audience, but some of those authors have successfully found the secret to the publishing world and can give us some of the answers to the questions that have us all a little confused. Tonight we have an expert, because he actually makes a living at his chosen profession, writing. Our guest tonight, Jonathan Mayberry, is a multiple Bram Stoker Award-winning author. He won not only for fiction, but nonfiction. Jonathan is a professional writer and writing teacher since 1979. He has sold more than 1,100 articles, 18 nonfiction books, 6 novels, short stories, poetry, song lyrics, video scripts, greeting cards, and 2 plays. I did say expert, didn't I? His fiction includes the Pine Deep Trilogy, which began with Ghost Road Blues, which was the winner of the Bram Stoker Award for the best novel in 2006, and includes Dead Man's Song in 2007, and this year, in May, he came out with Bad Moon Rising. And this book gave me nightmares, something I have to admit Stephen King's books have never done. Jonathan, welcome to Renee's Book Talk.
Renee, thanks for having me here. And I want to make one real quick correction. Actually, the Ghost Road Blues didn't win for best novel of 2007. It was best first novel.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually lost to Stephen King for best novel.
Aha! Uh-huh.
But if you're going to lose to Stephen King. And he won for Lissy's Story in that year.
Really? Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense.
Yeah, that was one of his most critically acclaimed novels, and nobody was surprised that he won, but I was very delighted to be nominated in the same category. But yeah, I won for best first novel after all, you know, 20 some years in the writing business. I took a shot at fiction, and it seemed to work out pretty well.
Well, before we get into the how of things, because you know a lot of the how, I want you to tell me about Bad Moon Rising, especially the folklore you spoke of in it, because that was very interesting. And I was curious, with all the research prior to writing the novel, did it come out because you were doing the research of the vampire universe, the dark world of supernatural beings that hunt us, haunt us, and hunger for us? My, that's a great title. Because both your nonfiction, The Vampire Universe, and your fiction novel, Ghost Road Blues, they both came out in 2006. So you did one because of the other, right?
Yeah, I had started the folklore research a couple of years ago. I did one folklore book prior to Vampire Universe, but it came out under a pen name. It came out under the name of Shane MacDougall. It's called The Vampire Slayer's Field Guide to the Undead.
Oh, my.
And, yeah, quite a title. And at the time, I was writing mostly books on martial arts. I've been doing jiu-jitsu for a lot of years. And my publisher at the time was afraid that my martial arts readers would freak out if I suddenly started writing about vampires. So he suggested I use a pen name. And that book came out, and it got much more attention than my martial arts books ever did. And I decided to re-explore that world under my own name and researched Vampire Universe. Now, the way I got involved in the whole supernatural thing, it comes from a childhood experience. My grandmother was a spooky old lady, wonderfully spooky old lady. I was born in 58, and at that point, you know, she was already in her 80s. You know, she was an older woman, and you know, she lived till she was 101. So I got a number of years with someone who was born in the 1800s and remembers, you know, rural France, Germany, and Scotland of that era and the superstitions that went along with it. So long before I ever discovered fictional monsters, I had learned from her about the folkloric monsters, the legends of vampires and werewolves in Europe that are substantially different than the versions we see in fiction and film. And then I discovered horror films, and it became a great love affair.
Oh, that is so interesting that your grandmother influenced you so.
Oh, yeah, and she was absolutely wonderful. Taught me how to read tarot cards when I was 8 years old. And,
oh, goodness.
She was great.
Did she tell you any interesting stories you can share?
Well, she was the interesting story herself. I mean, she was born with a caul over her face. A caul is an amniotic membrane that...
Yes, I've heard of that, the veil.
Yeah, the veil. And in a lot of belief systems, either that marks you as something very nasty, supernaturally speaking, or something very good. And in Scottish belief, a caul is a sign of the gift. And
the sixth
she
sense.
Was, sixth sense. She was very psychic. She did it somewhat to play with it. I'd bring a friend over to the house that she hadn't met yet, and she'd, you know, before I even could introduce, she would say, oh, hi, Stephen. You know, she would do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, our family was about to go to a shopping mall, an indoor mall, which back then was something of a rarity. I mean, we're talking a long time ago. And she had what she called her somethings. You know, something tells me you shouldn't do this, or something tells me you should. And she was very adamant that we not take this family trip that day, and got to the point where, you know, she was arguing with my parents about it and stood in front of the car to prevent us from driving away, and the mall burned down and 17 people died.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Now, at that point, as horrible as the tragedy was, and, you know, I did not mean to diminish it in any way, I was utterly fascinated by... you know, the thought that somebody, you know, could have extraordinary powers. My sisters, on the other hand, were totally creeped out by it. So from that point on, I was the one that would pay attention to what my grandmother had to say about things that go bump in the night, and they avoided the subject like the plague.
Yeah, see, I kind of stay away from that stuff because I've had a few of those episodes of my own, so I don't go too near it. I think that's why it gives me such nightmares.
Yeah, it's funny. I've never found that stuff disturbing. I mean, there are things I do find disturbing, but monsters and so on never really scare
when
me.
When they come in human form, they disturb me greatly.
well, yeah, I mean, the human monsters, say, for example, a lot of politicians, are scary to me. The only monster I was really terrified of as a kid, originally was werewolves, and I love werewolves. But then I got over the werewolf thing, and when I was 10 years old, Night of the Living Dead came out.
Oh, gosh, I remember seeing that.
Yes, that was 40 years ago. It was the 40th anniversary of that, and I thought that was just the coolest thing in the world.
I was horrified.
It scared the heck out of
me. Oh, it scared me, too. I went with my brother to a drive-in. That goes to show how old I am. And I sat there through most of that movie with my head in my hands. I was so scared, and I still didn't miss any of the graphic horror stuff, because every time I looked up, it was right there on the screen.
Yep. When I saw it, my sisters used to drop me off at the Midway Theater, one of those big old Art Deco theaters in Philadelphia, and I'd sneak up into the balcony, which had been closed for years. I'd sneak up there and sit and watch the movies. And, you know, by that point, I was already studying martial arts, you know, as a kid, so I'd figure out how to beat the different monsters. You know, I knew how to beat Dracula. I knew how to beat the Wolfman by that point. But with George Romero and Night of the Living Dead, I'm thinking, well, the numbers are against you. You're going to
mm-hmm.
lose. That was scary. Something was too big to fight. And that was really spooky. So go ahead.
I was going to say, in your novel, Bad Moon Rising, you killed quite a few people.
I do. And I even put zombies in it, too. There are a few... a few zombies in there, kind of a nod to the 40th anniversary of Night of the Living Dead.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was doing the folklore, I realized that most of the vampires and werewolves that people put in fiction are not the folkloric versions, because the vampires of folklore are substantially different. You know, the thing with sunlight and stakes, that's not folklore. I mean, even in the book Dracula, Dracula walks around during the sun, during the day.
Mm-hmm.
The sunlight thing was put in for the movie Nosferatu, a silent film. They needed a way to kill off the vampire, and that seemed like a good plot idea, so they put it in there. And now people think that's part of the folklore. Same with the cross and holy water. All of that was added to the folklore through fiction. But my grandmother told me about the older legends of vampires and werewolves, which was really different. And I thought how cool it would be to do a story. To, you know, if I was going to try a novel, I wanted to try one in which I could maybe surprise the readers by having things happen that they wouldn't expect, even if they knew the territory. And Bad Moon Rising, and it being the third book in the Pine Deep trilogy, boils up to the point where the characters are up against vampires of a different type, actually a couple different types in the book, and zombie-like creatures that are based on folklore, and they don't really have an easy time figuring out how to stop them.
No, they don't, not at all. I didn't think they were going to.
Yeah, well, a couple of them don't make it to the end of the book. So
I know, and I was very saddened by that, but I know that's the way it happens in books. So
yeah, that's also the way it happens in real life. I mean, you know, you don't have a war without sacrifice and
right.
The heroes going down in the heat of battle. And to me, the story had to have realism to it, and it's funny from the reader's point of view. It's painful to say goodbye to a character. From the writer's point of view, we look for opportunities to do harm to the characters we most love.
Yes.
Writers are kind of sick and twisted.
Yes, we are, aren't we?
Yes.
What were your goals when you started writing? I mean, did you have a plan from the outset to make a living at it, or did you just stumble across something that led you in that direction?
Well, I've always wanted to be a writer. I mean, I've never had any other desire as far as a career, even though I've worked in a number of different careers along the way, you know, to get to the point where I could, you know, do this for a living. But writing is what I've always wanted to do, and you know, I thought I was going to do it as a crusading newspaper reporter, which is the one thing I really haven't done. I went to school, Temple University, for journalism to learn how to be a newspaper reporter, but I never did that. I got involved in magazine feature writing because there was money in it at the time, and you know, you could break into writing by writing what you knew. So I wrote about what I knew, and you know, got into the biz that way. But and by the way, I never really set out to be a novelist. That wasn't in my game plan. It's just something that came to me a little later in my career, and I thought, you know, what the heck? It's worth a try at least. And since I've published in a lot of different weird areas, you know, greeting cards and plays and so on, I'm now of the opinion that unless I have tried it and completely failed at it, I'm going to go on the assumption that I can do it.
And you've even written plays, right?
Yep. My one play, the play that I'm most proud of is Tales from the Fire Zone, which was produced at Temple University. And it's a semi-improvisational play, which allows the actors to do a different type of play every time it's performed. And I have a draft of a novel based on it that as soon as I come up for air, I'm going to finish.
As soon as you come up for air, which means you're a very busy man.
I am, and I'm very, very thankful that I'm a very busy man. In fact, right now I'm working on a couple of new projects, one of which is working with a woman named Laura Schrock, who's an Emmy Award-winning TV producer. I sold a show to ABC Disney. They have kind of a new area for writers is what's called digital media. It's shows written for the Internet, shot like television shows, but actually, you know, placed on the Internet. They're very short.
Mm-hmm.
And we sold four seasons of a show called On the Slab, a horror entertainment news show.
Oh, for goodness sakes. I have to get you connected up with Real Splatter. Have you heard of them?
No, I haven't. That
sounds... Oh, they're going to be a guest next week. And this is
young
man who is so talented. You have to check out his website on MySpace. It's just Real Splatter. RealSplatter. You got to check it out. He is so awesome. And he makes all these... Yeah, he makes all these zombie and horror funny kind of little bits, you know, 12 minutes or whatever. You've got to check him out, and if you can be on the show next week, listen to him. He's 21 years old, and he's got amazing talent. But if you can get to his website on MySpace, you've got to go in and check it out.
I'll definitely do that. That definitely sounds like my sort of thing.
It is. I think you would just love it. I mean, it's horror, and it's funny, and he's just... He's amazing. I'm amazed at what he can do, you know, and produce and put on the net. It's just something else. So
fantastic. Well, he should be out there getting paid for it, and that's
yes, he is. He does make shows for graphic games and stuff like that.
Oh,
and
good for him.
Yeah, he is making a living at it.
I'm a big believer that writers should get paid for what they do.
And producers, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to announce real quickly, you're listening to Renee's Book Talk on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Yolanda Renee, and we're talking with Jonathan Mayberry, author of Bad Moon Rising, and a slew of other works that I can't name without taking up the entire hour. But if you want to call in with a question, the number is 347-215-9536. We got quite a few people in the chat room, so if you have a question there, please type it in. I will read it for Jonathan. Can you tell us what your writing habits are like? I mean, you're an awful busy man. How do you find the time to even write?
Well, it's my day job, so you know that I have to be at work every day. And luckily, my work is in my house. But you know, at usually around 8:15, 8:30 in the morning, I'm at my desk and I write straight through until about 5 o'clock. I try.
Now that's dedication.
Well, there's a couple things with that. One, if you're going to be a success as a writer, you've got to be dedicated, you've got to be focused, or you're not going to be successful. This is not a kind or forgiving profession. Second thing is there's a lot of talented writers out there, and the ones who are energetic, focused, and who know how to hustle a bit are the ones who are actually going to have a shot. You could be a tremendously talented author, but if you don't do what's necessary to get sold, get paid, and get out there, and get into the path of potential other projects, then somebody else will.
Yes.
And, you know, but also, you know, I love writing. I really love it. If there was a way to clone myself so that one version could just sit and write forever, I'd do it. I love writing that much.
I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. And the only reason I started Blog Talk Radio is it was marketing and the lack of it for fiction writers.
Yeah,
if you're nonfiction, you can generally get on a regular radio program because you're the expert considered in that field of what you've written about. But fiction doesn't really interest a whole lot of people unless you're Stephen King or Jonathan Mayberry, maybe. It's very difficult to market, and that's one of the reasons Blog Talk Radio is doing such a wonderful job. I think you're finding that out by appearing on several shows in the coming weeks, right?
Yeah, I'm doing a number of shows, and I just came back from doing Thriller Fest in New York, which is a major convention. I'll be doing Dragon Con in August and Monster Mania and Horrifying. You know, I do cons, I do chats, I do talks, I do a blog, I do social networks like Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn. Writers are expected to do all this. The thing about this, when the internet became a useful utility for communication, that's about the time that publishers pulled a lot of money away from what they would normally have invested in publicity for their books. Because they know that with the internet, authors can and indeed will because they want their books to be successful. So they just leave it up to the author to do it. Now, some people are not internet savvy and need to become internet savvy if they're going to be successful in books. There's no way around it. You have to learn how to become internet savvy. And you also need to learn how to figure out the time for that. It's very easy to get on the internet and say, get hooked on MySpace and do nothing all day but do MySpace.
Yes, you can. That's true.
So I actually budget a certain amount of time each day. I allow myself, depending on where I am in the release of a book, if a book's about to come out, then maybe a third of my writing day will be, you know, devoted to marketing. If I'm between releases, then it may only be a half an hour a day where I'm just going in and you know, going to MySpace, posting my blog, talking to a few folks who have posted or sent messages. I make sure to respond to every piece of mail I get. Anybody who sends a fan letter or just a note, I always respond. I think writers have an obligation to their readers because without readers, we're diarists.
I agree.
Plus, I mean, we're writing for the readers. You know, I take time to do that, and it's not like I know some writers who will write two or three versions of a response. And they cut and paste it when they get reader mail. And that's, to me, that's a cheat.
Oh, I had never heard of that.
Yeah,
I wrote a newsletter to send out to the few fans that I happen to have.
Well, and that's good because they do want to share, you know, and almost every writer I know is also a reader and a fan too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at Thriller Fest, you know, I was in the same room with, you know, James Patterson, Clive Cussler, James Rollins, R.L. Stein.
Oh my goodness.
Know, we're all in this room together and, you know, everybody is a fan of somebody else. Even if they're, you know, top of the game authors, they're still a fan of somebody else. So we respect the reader first, and that makes it fun. But the marketing thing, with the social networks that are out there, it's easier for writers to do it. The key, at least the secret that I, from my perspective, is if you look at it as this is difficult and time-consuming, then that's exactly what it becomes. If you look at it as this is fun, it's like a game to figure out how to get notice, how to get out there, how to get more going, then it becomes fun. And
I think you're correct in that. And you have to look at it that way because you don't want it to become a job. Otherwise, it's not going to be the fun that you intended it to be to begin with.
No. And there's too much of writing that could be difficult, could be depressing because you're sitting alone in a room for hours at a time. If it's not fun, it's going to tear you apart.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine it not being fun, even sitting in a room all alone, because you've got all your characters there. You've got that world you've created right there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have two things to say about that. First off, I won't name any names, but I do know authors who say that they like doing books, but they don't like the process of writing them, which is a statement that doesn't actually make sense to me. It makes
me
my brain
neither.
Think about it. The other thing is, in my writing class today, I teach a couple of writing programs, one of which is Write Your Novel in 9 Months. And we were talking today about the fact that our characters speak to us all the time.
Right.
My characters start conversations when I'm not sitting at the computer writing. And for most people, if there are conversations going on in your head, it's a cry for help and, you know, you might want to get
the I
prison.
Know. Yeah.
For us, it's a day on the job.
That's right.
And it's fun when my characters have somewhat of a life on their own. Of course, if I notice that my bank account's been tampered with and there are charges built to me, then I need to maybe pull the reins into my
into your imagination a little
head.
Bit, yeah.
But
Ethan is in the room. Well, Ethan is actually Walt Hunsinger, and he's the author of The Cabin. He's the Area 5 pen writers leader.
Hey,
and he wants to know, did you teach self-defense at Temple?
I did. I taught at Temple University for 14 years, teaching women's self-defense, men's self-defense, and martial arts history, among other courses. That was the job I had after I stopped being a professional bodyguard, which is a job I don't recommend.
A professional bodyguard.
Yeah, it sounds more glamorous than it is, but basically it's long periods of boredom followed by short violence and trips to the emergency ward. Not as much fun as it sounds.
I was just going to say, who were you guarding? But
people in the entertainment industry.
Oh, okay.
And it involves getting stabbed and run over and so other things that in TV, the hero shakes it off real quick. In real life, it's, you know, surgery and physical therapy and a bunch of other stuff. And
no fun at all.
No. When you're young.
Walt also wants to know, do you have any secret tips on querying?
Yes, I do.
Let's hear them.
All right. Well, first off, anyone who is listening to this, if you would like an example of what a professional query looks like, I invite you to drop me an email and I'll send you one. Email address is jonathan_mayberry@yahoo.com. I'll be happy to send you a query. Now, the secret to writing a good query is keep it short. Now, if you're talking book query, keep it short. Don't try to tell the entire plot of the book. And remember, it's a business letter. You're not trying to get somebody passionately interested in your book. You're trying to get them to understand that this book is going to do well with an existing demographic. So drop names of people who are successful in that genre. You know, when I sold Ghost Road Blues, I talked about, you know, how this type of book would appeal to the readers of Stephen King's Salem's Lot, of Peter Straub's Ghost Story, and so on. You name the books that are specific to your genre, and that way the agent, the editor, or whomever's reading that query can look at it and say, okay, there's an existing market out there for this book, therefore the book has value. This is because, remember, by this point, they haven't actually read any of your book. You want them to be excited enough about its potential for sale to want to read it.
So compare it to what's already out there.
Absolutely. And keep it short. Keep it to one page. Keep it professional. And there are some few formatting tricks, too. You know, you want to make sure that the query letter reads like a business letter, not like a personal letter. You're not talking to a friend. You're talking to someone who you may do business with. So keep it professional all the time.
That makes sense. I always ask the age-old question about writer's block, but I don't think you have a problem with writer's block, do you?
Actually, I don't believe in it. I really do not believe in writer's block. And let me explain what I mean by that, because some people look at me a little funny when I say that. Everyone I know who is under contract never gets writer's block.
Cool.
And it's not because we've been paid, because that can be actually somewhat of an intimidating thing when you've paid for a book and you've now got to produce the thing.
Uh-huh.
What it is it's having a deadline. It's having a process. If you know that you have to get a book done or a story done by a certain time, and it has to be a certain type of story, then the writer's block just evaporates. So one of the things I always recommend is when you're writing something, even if you are writing for the very first time, even if you don't have a deal or are years away from a deal, everything that you write, put on a calendar and give yourself a schedule and immediately set up a rewards system. So if you set a daily word count and you meet your daily word count, put a couple of bucks in a jar. Every day that you meet your word count, put those bucks in the jar. And then when you're done, say, the first draft, or even if you're done a chapter, take that money and go buy yourself something. Start equating completion with reward, and it's amazing how fast writer's block goes away, because we are definitely motivated by reward, and it's a long time coming in the writer's business before you actually get a physical reward. So if we build one in, then we like the process of progress, and we get things done.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say that, because I've never suffered from it myself. But if I get to a point where I don't know where to take the character or they're not speaking to me as clearly, I go for a 5-mile walk and it comes to me like that. So
yeah, I found I get my best ideas when I'm shampooing my hair. I'm not sure what that's all about. But there's also there are two other points about writer's block. Most people, when they're writing a book, think they have to write a book that reads like a final draft. And so they're so intimidated by the fact that their first draft doesn't read like a final draft that it stops them in place, and they're afraid to move forward for fear of doing it wrong. But nobody's first draft reads like a final draft. Nobody. I don't care who they are, Stephen King or James Lee Burke, nobody. You have to cut yourself a break and remember that first draft is entirely about just getting the story as raw, as clunky, as whatever, just getting it out. Because that's one part of the brain that's the storyteller. Then once that's out and you've given yourself your reward, you then let the other part of your brain, the part that's acquired craft, the part that knows about figurative language and so on, that part goes in and does revision. But if you try to do both at the same time, it's like a tug of war, and you're spending so much time on the struggle of, trying to get a perfectly written sentence that you don't get the sentence written at all. And it feels like a block because it's actually a struggle.
Well, that makes sense, too. So, what other secrets can you share with us?
One of the common questions I get with writers, I have a bunch of folks in my class, and they often ask, I've got two or three ideas, which one should I do first? My answer is always, which one would you have the most fun doing? If there's an idea that you would have the most fun, even if it isn't the most saleable idea, even if it's self-indulgent, doesn't matter. If you're going to have fun with it, do that one first. Let writing become fun first. And then, the process of writing that, as I said, even if it's not saleable, teaches you a lot about your writing skills. And, you wind up becoming a better writer so that when you get around to writing the thing that may be the most saleable, you'll have honed your craft. Another thing is never revise before you finish your first draft. Finish the first draft without any revisions. If you have ideas for the first draft, for how to change it, start a file called revision notes and keep a log. But don't stop to rewrite, because you'll get caught in that 100-page loop of, you get to 100 pages and you say, I think I should go back and change this, and you do, and then you get to 100 pages again, and you're just caught in that same strip. Those are really important tips. Another one is when you're writing, don't pressure yourself. If you know that you can do, say, 500 words a day, which is two double-spaced typewritten pages, then set your daily word count at 350. That way, if you do get the 500 words a day done, you're always exceeding your word count, you're always ahead of the game, and you're always feeling good about the process. If you don't, you start resenting the process of writing because you feel pressured, and as soon as you start resenting it, it stops being fun, you don't want to do it, and you don't do it.
That is true.
Yeah, you got to remember, you're an emotional being, and you've got to be fed emotionally. And if you pressure does not feed anyone emotionally, it's just the opposite of that.
That's true. Stress is not good for anybody.
No, really not.
Okay, I wanted to announce once more that you're listening to Renee's Book Talk on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Yolanda Renee. We have Jonathan Mayberry in the room. He's the author of Bad Moon Rising and a slew of other works. And I wanted to recognize the guests in the chat room and ask if there were any questions. JD says, ask him how much background research he does. And if he already talked about that, he's apologizing because he missed it.
That's a good topic because it speaks to what I'm doing now. I'm actually switching genres. My next book is not going to be a horror novel. Last year I made a deal with St. Martin's Press to write bioterrorism thrillers. My first one, Patient Zero, will be out in March, and that deals with plague. And I'm not a virologist or epidemiologist, so I had to do a lot of research on that. And there's some tricks to getting really good research. Now, first off, everyone who writes a novel should do some research, because no matter how, even if you're an expert, there's always somebody who knows something you might not know, and that might enrich your story. Second is, don't be afraid to ask real experts. I contacted, the top people in the world, literally in the world. I searched CNN stories and Popular Science stories and American Medical Journal stories to see who was being quoted in stories about diseases. So then I would say, if it was so-and-so at, say, Johns Hopkins University, well, I'd go to the Johns Hopkins website, go to the staff page, find their contact information, send them an email. Tell them I'm writing a book. Even if you don't have a publishing deal, they like talking to writers.
Great idea, because you're going to include them in the acknowledgments at least, right?
Yep, absolutely. And often I blog about some of the experts. Like right now, for my second book, it's dealing with an aspect of genetics called transgenics. And I've got a couple of Nobel Prize winners who are giving me information, and they're so delighted to be talking about this subject. You figure from their point of view, their family's tired of hearing about it. Their friends do this for a living, so it's not a conversation that's really new to them. But to explain the cool stuff to a writer, they get to indulge in all sorts of, first off, they know they're being listened to. What they're saying is being valued. It's going to be part of a novel which, gets you all sorts of cool geek points. And, the novelist wants to know the weird thing, the twist. And even though it may not be part of their daily research, they've definitely thought about it.
Well, of course they have.
And they'll give you the coolest anecdotes. I just got some information yesterday from a geneticist who told me some things that not only helped with the book, it actually resolved a major plot dilemma I was having and gave me the ending of my next book. And I'm pretty darn delighted. I would never have come up with that myself because my preconceived notions of genetics only went about so far, and they're a little out of date. This guy brought me up to speed with what's happening now, gave me a much fresher take on it. It's very cool stuff.
JD wants to know, Jonathan, if you talk to the expert, do you take hand notes or record the conversations?
Neither. I do everything via email. That way I don't misquote, I don't mistype, and I can just cut and paste what they say exactly. It's also easier for them to do it because when people talk, they tend to interrupt themselves, so they may start an explanation and then they get sidetracked and say something else, and you might miss information. Or if you're listening to a conversation, it's sometimes tough to get all the details out and typed down and recorded. Where with an email interview, they can take it and think about it. Sometimes they'll cut and paste stuff from their some articles they've done, or they'll like this guy yesterday sent me bunches of web links to articles that he's published, and also, he took a few weeks getting back to me with some of the answers because he really wanted to think about them. With an email interview, you get the deepest material and you never misquote. And also the fact that you have the email from them, agreeing to, actually providing you with information, stands as, permission, your proof of permission of using that information.
Yeah, and that's wonderful advice. I mean, everyone in the chat room is just enthralled by what you're saying. I don't know if you can see the chat room, can you?
Actually, I can't at the moment.
Okay.
No,
that's fine. I just wanted to make sure. Ethan or Walt has a question, and he wanted to know if you work through agents or directly with publishers.
Both. I started out representing my own books earlier in my career, and I represented the first 12 books I did, which were textbooks and a few mass market martial arts books. I do not recommend representing yourself. When I got an agent, first off, my deals got bigger. I got with bigger publishers, and my rights were much better protected. And I have, like a lot of authors who have been in the business a long time, I've been nailed by some unscrupulous things that have happened because
the fine print in the contract.
Yeah. And I'm not an expert on contract law. Agents are. Agents are. And there are ways of getting a good agent. And I advocate always trying to get the biggest possible agent you can, not going for someone who's just like middling class. Because the audacity of trying to get a big agent sends a message that you think that your writing is worth having a big agent.
That's really good advice.
Yeah.
I never thought of it like that.
And the agent I have now, I signed with her in the middle of 2005, and since then she has sold 11 books for me. So I really, really like my agent. And I also have a Hollywood agent for my film rights and the digital media stuff I'm doing for the internet and TV and so on.
I wanted to take a quick break here, if you don't mind. I wanted to announce my favorite charity. I was expecting Rick Galinas to sign on tonight via call-in so we could actually talk to him. He asked if he could be here, and I said most definitely. But Rick Galinas started a charity, and it's called Books for Boots. And what it is you take either your books or part of your royalties or just a cash donation, and you donate them to his charity called Books for Boots, and it's www.booksforboots.org, O-R-G. It's for wounded soldiers. It's a chance for the publishers and the authors to help out in a way that will get families to the hospitals. If you send books, they go directly to the soldiers to read, take their mind off of what's happening to them, what has happened to them. It gets their families there at their bedside via gas money, plane ticket, whatever it takes. He's trying to work out deals with gas companies and airlines, et cetera, to get, even more in the way of help. But if there's anything you can do out there, folks, I know he would appreciate it. You can sign on, like I said, at his website, www.booksforboots.org. And if he does call in, I'll interrupt the show again so he can say hello. But otherwise, we'll continue on. This is Renee's Book Talk on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Yolanda Renee. And Jonathan Mayberry is in the room, author of Bad Moon Rising and a slew of other works. The phone number, if you want to call in, is 347-215-9536. And the chat room, just keep typing in your questions, and I will read them. Christy, that's fine if you've got to get some sleep. I appreciate your being here tonight. I also wanted to announce that Walt Hansinger, the author of The Cabin, has been a valuable resource and has not missed one show of Renee's Book Talk. And, Walt, I thank you for that. I consider you my greatest fan. Anyway, Walt is the Area 5 Director for Pen Writers Group, a group of over 500 member writers. And it can be located at www.penwriters.com. It's a source for networking that can't be surpassed. And I think you'll agree, Jonathan, that that's one of the things that authors have to do is network.
Absolutely. Networking is probably the most crucial tool. It's one of the things we were talking about at Thriller Fest this weekend. Even you know, you have guys who are number one bestsellers, and they're talking about the value of networking, even at their career, in a career level. People like Sandra Brown, who's sold 350 million books, which is a concept that's hard to grasp, 350 million books, and she was saying that networking is the most important tool a writer can cultivate. And there's another reason for it, too. There was a point in my career, right around 2001, where I'd actually gotten burned out with writing. I'd been doing it for a long time, mostly concentrating on magazines and so on, and I just felt burned out. And part of the problem was I wasn't around other writers. And it didn't matter what level of writers, I wasn't around any writers. And I went to my first writers' convention around that time, and never been to a writers' conference before, and the workshops were good, you know, but what really, really got me going was being around others of my species, you know, because really writers get writers. And if you're not a writer, it's really hard to understand what makes you, you know, do what you do. And being around other writers was an amazing experience. It was transformative. And actually the second conference I was at was Pen Writers. And, I just was like, wow, there are other people who understand what I'm doing, and they're going through different versions of the same struggle that I'm going through, and it was great. It's like tapping into an energy source. I got so charged up at that point that my writing career literally shot through the ceiling and has not slowed down since. In fact, it keeps accelerating. And I credit having gone to writers' conferences and networking with other writers for that, you know, renewed energy burst that's not only given my career more drive, but, you know, that was around the time it got so busy that I was able to quit my day job and just write for a living.
Do you have you ever belonged to a writer's group where you take your work and get it critiqued?
No, I've never been in a critique group, but I run a number of critique groups through the writers' organizations. I have a number of different writing related businesses, and I advocate critique groups. But I also caution people if they're in a critique group, because they can, when they're done right, they're fantastic. When they're not, they can be a detriment. And the way in which they're a detriment is if people don't understand the purpose of the critique. Some people seem to think that a critique group is there to slam other people's writing, and that's not the case. It's there to talk about if something needs to be strengthened, make a suggestion. If something is good, talk about why it's good. If the group is, say, if everybody in the group is working on their first novel, well, you can't. You know, people are probably working on first draft or second draft. You can't critique it with the same standards that you would a final draft. So you have to adjust your critiques based on, you know, what you're working with. But when the people understand that, it's an invaluable resource. And many of my professional friends are in critique groups. Now, I do have first readers, people who read my early drafts and give me feedback. And boy, that's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, I just participated in what they call a beta reading group for Sue Lang, who's a science fiction author, and she's doing that online, and it was really quite interesting how she's doing it, and that's a lot of fun to be part of, and I'm starting my own writer's group. We meet for the first time next Saturday, so that's valuable information. But I agree with you. It needs to be, number one, you have to be serious about your writing, but number two, you have to be able to take what people are telling you with a grain of salt, so to speak, but at the same time, be open to what they're saying, because a lot of times I get such valuable information. They make me think about what it is I wrote, why I wrote it, and how I could make it better than what it was.
Absolutely. It also keeps you fairly honest. I mean, if you know you're going to the next peer critique group, you know you have to have something done. And you don't want to show up in in your worst pair of jeans, so to speak. So you know, you want to do a nice piece of writing so that you get good feedback. So it keeps you fired up. It keeps you going along, and they're just fantastic for that.
JD wanted to know if you listen to music or prefer the quiet, and what's your favorite time of the day to write. Now, I did tell him you write from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day.
Yeah, and on weekends I try to get about 3 hours in a day if I can. As far as music goes, I can write without music, but I do prefer noise. I am known for turning my CD player up moderately loud when I write. The only thing I can't listen to while writing is improvisational jazz. I've never quite figured out why, but I can listen to Irish punk, classical, you name it. My CD changer right now has Tom Waits, Leonard Cohen, Dido, Frank Sinatra, and something else on it. I mean, it's a weird mix, but yeah, I love music when I write.
I have a question for you. You're a founding member of the Liars Club. Talk about that.
Now, you asked about networking. There's an example. The Liars Club is a group of professional writers. All of us, everyone in the group has at least a 2-book deal or better. But we got together for the purpose of networking. Now, we have New York Times best-selling authors. We have Emmy Award-winning TV producers. We have, all sorts of writers in there, a lot of different genres. We have to network. So we formed the Liars Club, and the name comes from the fact that we make stuff up for a living. And we got together with the intention of helping each other's careers, because there's a lot more that can be done if a lot of people are pulling at the oars. So we do group readings, which is better for a bookstore anyway. It's less expensive in terms of marketing and advertising, and you usually get a better turnout. And so we do group readings, group signings. We're working on getting together our first Liars Club Afloat Writers Conference, which will hopefully be the year after next. We're mentoring and a number of people who are interning with us. We get somebody who wants to intern and help us out with doing some PR work, and as a result, they get 10 professional authors giving them advice on their career.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and we have some cool people in it. William Lashner, who's a New York Times bestselling legal thriller writer. L.A. Banks, who writes paranormal romances, and she's pretty much queen of that game. Greg Frost, who's a fantasy writer. Dwayne Straczynski, who writes for Marvel Comics and also writes crime novels, and a bunch of folks. It's a neat organization, neat group. We've been together for not quite a year yet.
Okay. I was reading the chat room, and they're talking about independent bookstores.
Mm-hmm. Love them.
Yes. Do you do a lot of book signings at independent bookstores?
Yeah, I do. All writers are required to do the chain stores, but truth be told, my love is the independents. Indies know books better, for one thing. I've never met somebody, whether they're an employee or an owner of an independent bookstore, who wasn't deeply knowledgeable about books. And they're there because they love books, not because it's just a paycheck. You also find books in independent stores that you never find anywhere else, because they know their readers, and they know what the readers want, and they make sure they have that. And there are some stores that I have long-standing relationships with that I love. Between Books down in Claymont, Delaware, at Clinton Bookstore in Clinton, New Jersey, the Harleysville Bookstore. There's a number that I just find, just wonderful places to do signings, readings. And also, that's where I shop for my books. I'll wait and go to an indie to get books rather than buy it from one of the chains. I know the chains give the discounts, but the indies, that's the heartbeat of the...
And they're quickly disappearing, so I think that's wonderful that you support them so well.
Yeah, and I've over the last year, some really great ones have gone away, and it's not a good thing.
No, it isn't. I keep watching the the book reports and stuff like that on it, and it's a sad thing to see them, because they do help out the unknown authors a great deal more than some of the big box stores do.
Absolutely, and they know you know, they form a relationship with their readers. I mean, if you frequent an indie, and there's something you want, they'll find it for you, and they'll make sure they get it for you. Whereas a chain might not, because it's not cost effective for them to get it. And you know, if you're a reader who has, you know, specialized tastes in certain authors, or wants to experiment with an author, you know, go to an indie.
I wanted to ask you, before we ran out of time, to talk about On the Slab.
Ah. Now, On the Slab is the entertainment, it's horror entertainment news show we're doing for ABC Disney. This new digital media thing is funny, because the shows are only 2.5 to 5 minutes long. And we sold 4 seasons of this entertainment news show, so each episode we got to cram a ton of stuff in that'll be 2.5 minutes long. So since everyone who goes to the internet, myself included, becomes thoroughly ADD as soon as we log on, we have the hostess who's going to be, you know, running the show. There'll be constant movie clips going on with her commentary, and experts of various kinds. There'll be like a CNN sort of crawl going along the bottom, and there'll be pop-ups like VH1 pop-up. So there's constant information overload and real obscure and neat stuff. If somebody's very knowledgeable about horror movies, there's going to be stuff there they don't know. So we're having fun with that. And it's the first digital media show sold to a major network from someone outside of the industry. I mean, we're not employees of ABC Disney. We're outside contractors. So we kind of, and Laura Schrock and I kind of created this mold. And now a lot of people are doing this sort of thing. So it's kind of cool to be on the front wave of it. And it's also a faster turnaround, too. I mean, we turned in what's called the Show Bible, which is the guide to how the first season is run, you know, descriptions of all the episodes, and a sample script. Though the show we produced down in Hollywood, we want to make sure that it's going to be produced the way we envision it. Yeah, well, not. I mean, it's going to be professional. It's ABC
right.
Disney. But we want it to be our vision of the show. So
I see.
The Show Bible gives them the guidelines so that the version that they shoot is going to be the version we want. And that's fun. So
now,
the movies are
about what? Specifically, you said movie.
Well, for example, like we did one segment on the physics of superhero movies. We did another one on, you know, iconic female characters in horror films. So we have everything from, you know, Ellen Ripley from Aliens to Linda Hamilton from The Terminator, and you know, segments like that. So you'll have clips of those movies while the commentary is on discussing it, and while the experts are talking about, you know, the elements of it, you'll have clips from those films in the background. And those clips are acquired by the licensing department at the network.
And you don't have a website or set up for that yet?
No, we actually won't have a website for that, because we sold the show to them.
Oh.
So, you know, they'll be positioning it in hundreds of places on the internet once the shows are produced.
Oh, I see. Gosh, it's going to be its own little CNN, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And you know, it also gives us a chance to do some interviews. I just interviewed John Carpenter yesterday, and that was a lot of fun. You know, the guy who directed Halloween and Starman and everything. And I interviewed him for two purposes, one for that show and also for a nonfiction book I'm doing on supernatural predators and folklore, fiction, and film. So that was fun.
I'll bet. That sounds like a great time.
Yep.
Ethan or Walt wants to know, where do you get your inspiration? Is it daily life, movies, other works?
Most, for horror, it was researching folklore. I love reading nonfiction and looking for where the story might be in the nonfiction. For the thrillers I'm writing, I'm addicted to Popular Science magazine. I'm a science junkie. So actually, most writers are knowledge junkies to begin with. So I look for something that of interest, and then I guess it's because of my journalism training, I look for what the hook is. What's the thing about that I don't know and that I would find cool? And if it's something I don't know and it's a subject I'm knowledgeable on, then that might be something somebody else might find interesting. And then, of course, you know, there's some formulas for turning it into a novel, like if there are characters involved, what are their motives? What do they want out of the story? And then you keep researching the nonfiction background. The author David Morrell, the creator of Rambo, is one of the is a really great gentleman. I've met him a few times, and he's covered quite a my latest book. And he speaks a lot about the nonfiction background that authors have an obligation to the reader to know a subject, but most authors who really want to write a good book immerse themselves in a subject. So we get to be obsessive about something for a while, you know, research it, become really knowledgeable, write a story, and then we move on to some other obsession. So that's one of the fun parts of writing.
Where can our listeners see or hear you next?
Unfortunately, I'm embarrassed to say I don't have my calendar in front of me, and I've got a million things set up. The biggest thing that's going to be coming up is DragonCon at the end of August, Labor Day weekend. That's down in Atlanta. It's 30,000 people, and I'll be premiering my new book down there, which is called Zombie CSU, The Forensics of the Living Dead. That's a kind of a weird book. I interviewed 250 experts in law enforcement, medicine, forensic science, the military, and so on. Since it's the 40th anniversary of Night of the Living Dead, I wanted to do a book on zombies. So I asked them, if something like Night of the Living Dead happened, how would the real world react? So all these world-class experts, from 911 operators to Homeland Security, gave me their opinions on how we'd react. I put that in a book, and I'm premiering it at DragonCon.
Wow.
So it should be a lot of fun.
Now, it's called the Dragon?
DragonCon.
DragonCon.
Yeah, it's one of the bigger, it's a fantasy convention in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's one of the bigger genre conventions. It's this year, they expect 30,000 to 40,000 people to be
My
there.
My goodness.
Yeah, it's huge. It's my first time at DragonCon. I'm very honored to be asked to be a guest there. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a blast.
Julia's writing a book about dragons, and she says she has to go to Atlanta now.
Oh, yes, she must go. And if she does, make sure she introduces herself and say hi.
Do you hear that, Julia? He wants you to say hello. Do you have any advice for aspiring writers, people out there struggling just to get started?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, absolutely do not give up. I mean, if you love to tell a story, don't let anything deter you from telling the story. You know, if it takes you a while to get published, just remember, I mean, J.K. Rowling, 117 rejections of Harry Potter. Stephen King, 63 rejections for Carrie. Don't let anything deter you, you know. And the second part is, you know, constantly hone your craft. There's no writer out there who can't improve their skills, no matter how good they are. And we all do it. I mean, we all constantly improve our craft. The third thing is develop a very thick skin. Rejection happens to everybody. So don't take it to heart. Just say, okay, if I got rejected, then I'll keep trying. You know, for every rejection letter that comes in, put three more queries out there. Those are really important points. And the last thing, and this is the most important of all, have fun with it or don't do it.
I agree totally. I mean, and that is great. Great advice. Thick skin, hone your craft, and get ready for a rejection, and just keep putting it out there.
Yeah, and you know, if you believe in your stuff, you know, I honestly, I'm a big fan of the power of positive thinking, or power of intention, as some people call it. If you really want it to happen, and you just keep focusing on it happening, it will. You know. I've seen that happen over and over again with people who just believe in it so much, and you know, they may not have published before, so they have no proof they're good, but they believe in what they're doing, and maybe that's some sort of a magic spell, but it does seem to work.
Well, we've got about 90 seconds before the show is over, and I do want to say thank you to all the people who showed up in the chat room tonight. I want to say a special thank you to Jonathan. I mean, I thought your talk tonight was just enthralling. I was hanging on every word and not doing much of an interview because I let you take it away.
You give good interview. You ask the right questions, and also the people in the chat room ask some great questions too, and I thank you for that too, because it's fun to share, and you guys made this easy.
Well, you did a wonderful job, and it has been a lot of fun. I've written down just about everything you said, even though I know it's going to be on archive, and I'll send you the podcast via email.
Great, and I'll put it on my blog.
Okay. So So as the show ends, I just want to say thanks again. I want to announce that next week on Renee's Book Talk, we're going to have Ashley Ladd, a romance author. And on the 31st, we're going to have Mike Lombardo, a filmmaker from Central Pennsylvania. And if you want to check out his work, you have to go to his MySpace page under myspace.com, Real Splatter, R-E-E-L-S-P-L-A-T-T-E-R. But be prepared, because he's got some awesome stuff there. And if you're not used to seeing zombies in full force, then you don't want to go. But if you love that kind of stuff, you got to check it out.
I'm heading there right now.
Mark your calendars for those dates, and please show up back here. And thank you again. Switchboard is off. Good night, everybody.
Thanks, Renee.
Hey, it was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was great. I enjoyed it. And I hope people can use it and get their careers rolling, because that's more fun when everybody's successful.
And I think it's going to be a very popular archive on the website, too.
Because
everyone in the chat room was just going on about how wonderful, you know, everything you had to say was, and how informative it was.
Oh, well, I had a great time, and you know, as I said, if you're having fun with it, then you're doing the right thing.
Well, like I said, this is booked all the way up through the end of October, so there, you know, it's a necessary evil,
and
it is a lot of fun. And I'm meeting a lot of wonderful people, and you're one of them. So I appreciate the fact that you jumped on board. I mean, I sent that email out, and you were one of the first people to respond. So I do appreciate it.
My pleasure. And again, thanks for doing this. This is a good thing for writers and good thing for readers, and it's a good thing. So congratulations.
Well, I'll check out your other shows.
Okay, great.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot, and good night.
Take care, Renee. Bye.
Bye-bye.